Blog Talk Radio.
Join us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and listen to us at www.naturestalkshow.com.
Good evening, everyone. This is Ken McKean welcoming you to Nature's Talk Show and tonight's Biotopes. I'm here tonight with Ken Borman. Hello, Ken. How are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you, tonight, Ken. How are you?
Pretty good. We got some really cool habitats tonight we're going to talk about. But before we get into that, Ken and I want to invite our listeners to please tune in to Nature's Talk Show, www.naturestalkshow.com on the Internet. And you can click on our chat room and join in our live chat there. And Ken will be in the chat room to take questions and that you might have about tonight's subject. And Ken and I are going to take our listeners to, how would you describe these habitats, Ken? Fragile, sometimes with a hostile beauty or something like that, you know?
All of that and more, I think.
And more, yeah. But Ken Borman grew up in Australia, and I, of course, grew up here in North America. So Ken is familiar with some of the deserts of Australia, and I've been to several of the deserts here in North America. So we're going to talk to a little bit about our experiences with these deserts and some of the wildlife and amazing rocks and stuff and other things that we've seen in these and very interesting habitats. And I want to myself take a trip down under with Ken here. So, hello once again, Ken.
All right. Let's see. I first heard of a desert in Australia at school. We were taught, like this is 50 years ago, probably 55 years ago, we were taught there was a desert in the center of Australia. It's a very arid continent, the driest continent in the world. And we were taught the Simpson Desert was in the center of Australia, and that was it. Wow. In the last 55 years, things have changed. They've picking up that Simpson Desert into 10 different deserts now. I don't know why they did that. Probably a geological or geographic, some sort of reason, topographical maybe, I don't know. But Australia has officially 10 deserts now. I've only been to one of them. I live mainly on the coast of Australia, but I can assure you it's very dry there.
Now,
what would you like to know, Ken?
Well, what? There's so much. Well, I guess what was a lot of the topography like there? I mean, I'm looking at a photograph here of the Strzelecki Desert, is it?
The Strzelecki Desert, yeah.
Strzelecki Desert.
It covers a little bit of South Australia, Queensland, and New South Wales. It's probably one of the most easternmost deserts of Australia. It's the one closest to where I live. That's how come I've been there, I guess.
It looks a lot like New Mexico. If I look at the one photograph here I'm seeing of the desert there, if I was to see a picture of it sitting next to a photograph of New Mexico here in the northern Chihuahua Desert where I'm at, it's beautiful how identical they are. I'm looking at the grasses and stuff, So. On another hemisphere, we're seeing this beautiful convergent evolution of these different these habitats. I think that's amazing, Ken.
Yeah. Well, basically, it's very flat. The center of Australia is actually basically a depression. In paleontological terms, or ages, there used to be an inland sea, a freshwater sea, in Australia. Many eons ago, and that's dried up for various reasons until Australia's now, as I said, the driest continent on the planet. Very flat. There is a mountain range through the center of Australia, which I think is probably why they started to break up the deserts, because I guess you can't really call a mountainous area a desert.
Yeah.
But that breaks it up, and that's probably why one of the reasons why they started breaking up the Simpson Desert into different smaller deserts. There are dune deserts in Australia, just like the famous Sahara Desert, like you expect to see there. But some of them are quite large, actually. But on the whole, it's this red, flat soil, if you want to call it soil.
Yeah. The caliche, probably, like, isn't it?
Yeah, it's well leached out. It is basically red. We call that bull dust. And when you're driving there, you can have all your windows up and everything. But it's so fine, it gets in and puts a coating on everything in your car. That's a bit of a pain that way.
I understand that.
Hard to breathe. That makes it hard to breathe, too. The other type of deserts in Australia, there's stony deserts. And it's just like, what can I equate it to? Probably, you've seen those pictures of English beaches that are made up of rocks, I guess. Some of the English beaches, instead of sand, they have rocks there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of like that.
Hmm. That's interesting.
And there's actually more vegetation in the sandy deserts in Australia than there are in the stony deserts.
Yeah.
Because at least I guess there's purchase for the plants to grab hold of in the sand.
Yeah.
Probably than in the rocks.
Yeah, the similar, you know, here, our situation here, we see that, you know. Do you have an idea how, well, I guess the desert is described as 10 inches of rain or less a year.
Yeah, that's probably why they basically classify all of inland Australia as desert.
but it does get its rain, doesn't it?
It does, but it mainly gets its rain through runoff, gets its water through runoff.
Uh-huh.
Every time there's a really good monsoon across the north of Australia, it's in the tropics, so they have got monsoon season. About one in every, it used to be one in every 20 years, but because of El Nino effects in Australia over the last, say, probably 30 or 40 years, it's been pretty rare. But when they have a good monsoon, all the river systems in the north overflow, and instead of draining into the ocean, they get so much water in them that they actually flow backwards, more or less, into the basin, the Great Australian Basin, which is,
yeah,
as I say, the saucer, the depression area in the centre of Australia. So really, it might not rain in the centre of Australia all that much, but they do get the water through those rivers that do flow backwards for a little while until they become an inland river.
Yeah.
There are river systems all through the desert, Mark, but they very seldom run.
Wow. That's pretty cool. Now, we have a variety of wildlife here. What kind of, now, and Australia, of course, has wonderfully unique indigenous life forms. What are some, I imagine reptiles and things like that were probably the masters of these desert areas. But were there wallabies and things like that that live in these areas?
Yeah, the kangaroos are basically too big to live in the desert.
Yeah.
There are some small kangaroo is a wallaby, obviously. So there are some of the smaller wallabies that live in the desert, on the outskirts of the desert. They don't live in the center of the desert.
Yeah.
It's just too dry for even them.
Wow.
And there are a lot of small marsupial mice that live in the desert, too. That are only the size of like a house mouse or or a hamster. Maybe hamster size might be the biggest. There's a lot of species of them, probably because they're broken up by the mountain range. So they've, Australia being a very old continent too, they've had long enough to speciate. And they're all in there. But as you say, there are a lot of reptiles. And things like scorpions, insects that do live in the desert. There are snakes. The majority of the reptiles that live out there are lizards. We've got a thorny devil there, which is the same as your what do you call that thing in New Mexico, Ken?
We have our horned lizards.
Yeah.
Sometimes called horny toads.
actually, look very much like your horned lizard. So, and it does the same thing. It eats ants.
It eats ants.
It's an extreme case of vergid evolution, I guess, because they're nowhere near related. Obviously.
No, but I think I was probably in high school when I was around 13 or 14. I remember getting a book on reptiles and seeing the Moloch or thorny devil. And I've always been intrigued by that reptile, you know, that lives down there, you know. And but it is. I think it's an amazing example of convergent evolution of two different separate reptile lizard families, you know, because both are, you know, the horns and spines on these, to me, these lizards are amazing.
Yeah, and that's obviously to catch the deer, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They've both evolved exactly the same ways of getting water by exactly the same method, actually.
You know,
it's staggering.
I've seen horned lizards in the early morning out here when we'd be out working, and you'll see them sitting there with a little bit of dew, you know, that's actually settled on them in the deserts out here. You know, it's interesting how these things work. You know, those little horns funnel the water to their head. You know, and they're able to capture that little bit of moisture that they need. You know.
Yeah. And as we said too, the desert systems are very fragile in an extreme balance. So if there's too much of a thing, it destroys its own food source, and the population crashes, and in which time the food source has a chance to recover, and it goes all up and down the line. So
yeah.
We've got a problem in Australia with the introduction of foreign animals, just like I assume you have in the Chihuahuan desert too, Ken.
Yeah. These animals come in, and it doesn't take much to mess up one of these ecosystems. You know, it's really funny when people see a desert. I remember my first experiences with it, you know. It was like, wow, this is an amazing, you know. That, I mean, you almost have to experience a desert. It's hard to really, you know, to say the feeling you get in one, you know, what you really feel. Because I grew up in the Midwest of North America, you know. It's basically where you're at now. You know, lots of trees and farmland and stuff, you know, lots of rain, you know. And when you come to a place where rain, you know, the water's fragile, and you see these deserts, you know, come to life, like you mentioned. Now, like you mentioned, you know, the monsoon. What's it like when you get a good rain there, Ken? Is it like here, where the desert just in the collar, you know? I mean, it's amazing to watch it here here in New Mexico change.
It does change dramatically. As I say, it's mainly through runoff, through flooding, that the water comes down into the desert regions of Australia. The strange thing is, there's a lake there that fills, as I said before, it used to fill about every 20 or so years. But it's a major breeding site for pelicans.
Really? Yeah. Pelicans.
And they somehow know the pelicans all around Australia. It's all the same species, as far as I know. They seem to know when the floodwaters from the north will get into Lake Eyre. I don't know how, because it can take up to 3 months to travel that distance. It's a long way. But all the pelicans migrate or flock into the center of Australia, and they all breed there. They all set up their nests, they lay their eggs, and they raise their chicks there, because they know that, first off, there's not much competition. There's not much predators. And we have fish in Australia that they're a lot like your killifish cat. They more or less either estivate, or certainly we've got frogs do that as well.
Yeah.
There's amphibians living in the desert. but then that's how they survive.
Really?
Yeah. But the fish eggs are present there, and as soon as water hits them, they start to develop. And by the time the bird, the pelicans have timed themselves so that they arrive there, build their nests, lay their eggs, hatch their chicks out, and by that time, all the fish have hatched out, and they've been around for a little while, so they're starting to get a little bit of size on, and that's what the pelicans can eat, and then feed onto their hatchlings.
Now, you
it's
got me here, Ken.
I don't mean like hundreds of birds. I mean thousands and thousands and thousands of pelicans.
Yeah. Well, I bet you that dates back to when that giant freshwater lake was there. You know it? And the habit of migrating
probably,
there is still in them. And but the fish. Tell me real quick about those fish again. I got to hear this again, Ken. This is...
Well, there's gobies.
These guys lay eggs that go into a diapause?
Yeah.
How come we don't know about this? I'm sitting there. You just told me something I have not heard about ever. I am freaking out here on this, Ken.
They've got a very like killifish, but an extreme killifish, I guess.
Yeah.
Because as I say, it can be 20 years.
Jeez.
And they do develop very quickly, much like, you've seen the frogs that burrow, and well, even lungfish in Africa that estivate. And as soon as they sense moisture, they kind of wake up. They come out of the hibernation, and they're ready to go. And as soon as the water has softened the clay that they're in enough, they burst forth and multiply.
Yeah.
It's basically the same idea in Australia, but they go right from the egg in Australia.
That's very interesting. I did not know that there was another fish species that had evolved a desert egg, an egg that could withstand the desert. And this is a long-term egg, right?
Oh, yeah, it is.
Oh, my gosh.
Basically, they're gabies, as I understand it.
Well, that's very fascinating. I want to know more about that fish. Yeah, we'll have to find more about that for another show.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's too fascinating. Too fascinating. Boy, we don't have anything like that here in the Chihuahua Desert, that's for sure.
Well, it's surprising. You know, when I used to watch the movies when I was a kid, and you're in the Sahara Desert and you saw all those oases in the movie, I always thought, all that freestanding water there must be fish in them.
Yeah. And
there are.
Yeah.
Or there were in some instances. So, but that was freestanding all the time, water. These ones, this is very, very marginal and temporary.
Wow, that's very fascinating. I'm now, several years ago, Dr. Lucas and I, Dr. Spencer Lucas, for our listeners, is my mentor at the New Mexico Museum of Natural History and Science here, where I'm a research associate. And he and I were having a talk about back in the Permian, if there could have been the evolution of an annual paleonicet. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And how we'd find it. But listen, hearing this right here, you know, this says, okay, there absolutely could have been a convergent evolution of an annual fish from the paleonicet line living in some of the desert areas of Pangaea, possibly. You know, where the eggs could have survived like this. That would be so fascinating, but it'd be almost impossible to prove. But that's very fascinating.
That's probably a bad term for it. I wouldn't call it an annual fish because it doesn't happen every year.
Yeah, this is even better than an annual fish, you know. I mean, this is survival, extreme 101 here.
Mm.
Fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
That's amazing. Now, I imagine that you probably have similar things like we have out here, like fairy shrimp and things, apis, and that would hatch out in these temporary pools and stuff too to help those kind of critters?
Yes, they do. Yeah, that's what the little fish eat when they hatch out. There's fairy shrimp, triops. Australia has their own, I think there's 3 species of triops from Australia.
Yeah.
Some of them get quite large, as triops go, up to, you know, 3/4 of an inch. But there's certainly fairy shrimp out that way too. And again, they have that same lifestyle habit of hatching out from eggs as soon as there's moisture around and taking advantage of whatever available moisture there is.
You know, that's one of the things that always, I think, where my biggest fascination lies with the desert, you know, is how these things like that, you know. When I came out here, I found more fairy shrimp species than I did back east, you know. It's like, you know, these things, they thrive for these habitats. Amazing.
I wonder, too, if there isn't, like, sizes. Different species have evolved to take advantage of different degrees of moisture, if you know what I mean. Like if something, maybe there's a species that when it rarely rains in the center of Australia or in the Chihuahuan Desert, whatever desert we're talking about, I wonder if there's a species that has evolved that only hatches out when there's been like an inch of rain or something.
Hmm.
And then they have a very, very short life, obviously. They procreate and die basically like some insects do. They only live for 24 hours. And I wonder if this happens, and then there's other species that have evolved that only come out of estivation, if you want to call it that, or whatever, or diapause. When there's like 6 inches of water or a foot of water or something like that. I'm only supposing here. I'm not sure. But do you think that's possible, Ken?
Yeah, I do. I think that might be, it's interesting because sometimes I've seen pools out here get a little bit of water in them and nothing hatch.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a few weeks later you get a big rain and then you have a big hatch. So... But that's a very interesting deal, you know, because I do believe there's the apis species that evolved for you know, drier areas as well. I think we talked about that, I believe, on the show, didn't we?
Yeah.
These things are really amazing, you know.
And of course, we have all different triops and fairy shrimp on the east coast too, where I grew up. Where we have a moderate rainfall. At least rivers that flow all the time. But those species would die in the inland. There's just not enough water for them. But it's just what you're growing up used to, I guess.
Yeah, we, the species we have here, you know, they like, when we get the warm summer rains, they hatch, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. So, well, what else you want to tell us about the Australian desert, Ken?
Well, maybe some of the introduced animals that are a problem in Australia.
Yeah.
there's two I want to mention in specifically. One, I would assume, would be a problem in the Chilean Island Desert 2, and the other one I doubt would be. The one that I doubt would be a problem in the Chilean Desert is camels. There are camels in the center of Australia. They were brought over from Saudi Arabia or the Arabian Gulf. I don't know what country they came from. I think Saudi Arabia.
Mm-hmm.
At the turn of last century, like the 1900s, as pack animals, because people wanted to go from north to south, across the continent, or east to west. So they were brought as pack animals to carry everything.
Yeah.
As what happens everywhere, some of them got loose. And they're used to living in a desert. So they bred up and became feral. Now, there are no natural herbivores, to my knowledge anyway, that live in the deserts of Australia.
Hmm.
Everything's carnivorous. So all of a sudden, you've got this introduction of a large beast. Camels are very big.
Mm-hmm.
That does require it to eat vegetation. All the vegetation in the center, in the deserts, has evolved without having that problem. So they kind of decimated vast areas.
Oh, my gosh.
Just through eating. And then as they're walking, too, they're such big, heavy animals that they create paths through the desert, which lead to erosion.
Yeah. I'll be darned.
So the unexpected byproduct of that is the Australian camels are actually purer than the existing Arabian camels now, and we're exporting them back to Saudi Arabia.
Because no
kidding. Better camels than they can get in the wild in Saudi Arabia. So there you go.
that's incredible. Oh,
so, that's the problem there. But the other major problem in Australia is probably one that you'll find in the Chihuahuan Desert too, and that's feral cats.
Yeah.
It's amazing. When I was in the desert in the Strzelecki Desert in Australia, it's dead flat. No tree in sight. All you see is little clumps of spinifex. That's what we call that spiky sagebrush, I think you call it.
Yeah.
And you're standing there in the heat. It's 45 degrees. I don't know what that is in Fahrenheit. It's very hot. It's probably 140 or something. And you're sweating, and you think, how can anything live here? And you don't see any movement. All right, so that's fine.
Yeah.
Nighttime comes, cools down, and you look out from your campfire, and all you can see is eyes. And that's feral. Really? And that's feral cats.
Cats?
Again, I'm not talking 10 or 20 cats. I'm talking hundreds of cats.
Holy cow.
And they're decimating all the little marsupial mice. Even some of the wallabies, they're predating on their joeys. Certainly any amphibians that are out there, scorpions, they'll eat anything. Birds, the birds that are adapted to living in that sort of condition, they'll go in. If they don't eat the birds, they'll eat the eggs out of the nest. And they're a huge problem in Australia.
Man. I think that's one of the worst animals the humans tried to domesticate, you know? I mean, they kill so many animals around the world. They've wiped out, made some species extinct on some of these island habitats. You know, these things are just Then, of course, you got a large population that just loves those animals, you know. And it's like, oh boy.
Little five-pound, cute and cuddly little furry animals either. These are like 10 to 15 pounds. Cats out of hell.
Yeah. Oh, man.
But so. I would expect that you'd have that problem in the Chihuahuan, too, would you, Ken?
We got all kinds of, we got, I think probably here in the Chihuahuan Desert, one of the biggest problems that we have as far as animals being introduced are cattle.
All right.
Yeah, these things, I grew up in, as I mentioned, the Midwest. I lived in farm country. I grew up on farms, you know, and worked around cattle. I worked on a dairy farm for a while, you know, and I got to know these animals. And they do so well back east where there's lots of grass, you know, lots of rain and, for them. You put them out here in a desert habitat. I forget how many cattle you could grow on an acre back like in Indiana. But out here, it's like one cow per 40 acres that you can grow. And it takes that much grass because there's no grass out here. And what's happened in the last 150 years by ranching has actually changed the dynamics of the Chihuahuan Desert very, very much, especially in the way of plant profiles and changes in the water table.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, it's your turn to ask me questions now.
All right. If I was going for a stroll in the Chihuahuan Desert, away from any habitation, what would be the first animal I would see?
Oh, let's see here. As we head out and everything, we're driving around through the lower parts of Chihuahuan Desert. One of the commonest animals we have, I guess, would be equivalent to a wallaby there, and that'd be the jackrabbit.
All right. Okay. So they have evolved to live in that arid situation.
Yeah, they got big ears to help with heat control. We see lots of jackrabbits here. We have them living in my area. I live at the very northern end of the Chihuahuan Desert, but I've been a couple hundred miles to the south of it and observed different parts. Another interesting animal that we're always happy to see, and that's pronghorn antelope.
All right, I've heard of them.
Yeah, every now and then.
Quite rare, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. We'll see some. I think the biggest group we've seen has been around 15 or so animals. Most of the time, we'll see 2 to 6 animals in little herds when we're out driving, and they're wary too. They'll bolt at an instant, and so we see those. And one of the interesting things here too is we have a lot of hawks in this area. The desert here has several species of hawks.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's and now here's something that's going to find interesting too. We've had our first bald eagle the other day. We saw here in the northern edge of the Chihuahua Desert. They're moving back into the air. Yeah, so the bald eagle has returned here to this area.
So that was original habitat at one stage for bald
eagles.
Yeah,
they lived all along the Rio Grande River.
Wow. Well, that's good news then.
Yeah.
Very good news. Excellent.
Yeah, there's, like I said, seeing that, we've got a little bit of hope now. The river, now the Chihuahua Desert here covers parts of New Mexico, Texas, and extends quite a ways into central Mexico. It's an inland desert. It also encompasses part of Arizona. Some places, the plants are very desert oriented. We have areas where about the only thing growing is creosote bush. Now this is kind of cool where the desert borders up against some of the little mountainous areas. We see a real interesting selection of animals and plants there. Cactus become more common, seems like, in these parts like that. We see barrel cactus that'll grow up along the hillsides here in southern New Mexico. Those are pretty cool. Some of the plants we have. We have what's called Joshua trees, and I don't think you might not have anything quite like those down in Australia. What these are, they're a type of yucca, and they'll send up several branches. They're actually, to me, really cool looking. Big spiky leaves at the top of a crown. But they send a root, tap root, that goes pretty deep. But they also send out an outer root system that extends for 50 to 60 feet around the plant itself. And that helps them have an area for each one to collect water when it rains here during the desert monsoon season.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
the all-important water, you've got to collect it somewhere, don't you?
Yeah, that's what the plants here in this particular area have developed. They have shallow roots that reach way out around the plant. And now, one of the problems we have here in this area of New Mexico are people that go out and poach these plants. They'll bring in the yuccas. They'll bring in some of the cacti. They'll go out and bring in these Joshua trees. And these Joshua trees are really old. You know, it takes them a long time to reach any size. And what people do, they seem like they'll dig down for a little bit, realize it's about 150 in the, you know, temperature out there, 150 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
So they break them off, maybe a foot down after digging, and you got this broken taproot. And what happens, they take these things and they'll set them out along the highways out here and sucker gringos from back east that move out here and they want to do some landscaping into buying these. These people take them home, they plant them, they think everything's good and great because all at once these trees will send out a flowering spike.
Right.
Like I said, they're a type of yucca, so they have a long yucca flowering spike with the white yucca-type flowers, they're a type of lily. After they send out the flowering spike, guess what happens to them next? They die.
Yeah. So it's a last-ditch effort to further their species, I guess.
Yep. And hundreds of these plants are taken by humans, you know, and they try to sell them, you know, for landscaping. I've never, ever been suckered by one of these people. And I always feel, you know, bad when I see these people doing it. You know, it's
have some
trying to make a quick buck.
Made that illegal, Ken?
No, it's not.
Wow.
Yeah. These, as far as I know, these plants are not listed as endangered. You know, when we talk about the Sonora Desert now, we'll mention that real briefly. Over there, you know, they've got the, doggone it, saguaro cactus, you know.
Right.
And
the
saguaro and its cousins are all endangered. It's illegal to go out and take those. You get caught digging up a cholla, and you'll get a really hefty fine. So,
well, that's good, isn't it?
Yeah, it is good. It's awesome. You know, because here's the nice, cool thing about it. You and I have talked a lot on the green scene, and we talk about these rare plants, and most of the time, there's a place that you can get captive-grown plants of these species.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and it's the same way with these saguaro cactus. If you want a saguaro, go to a nursery that is legitimately raising these things from the seeds. So that's what they do. And I've seen them as cheap as 99 cents for a little baby cholla or a saguaro.
Really?
Yep.
Wow, that's very inexpensive.
Yeah, yeah.
But it costs more to drive out and try and poach one from the wild. Just need gas.
Exactly.
Wow.
Yeah, so there's a kind of a happy story there, Ken.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad that they're doing something about them there. Maybe they should look at doing that to the Joshua tree, too. But then if they're not endangered, I guess it's very much a sucker beware.
They should be endangered, though, because they take them out too fast, you know.
Yeah.
And they're really cool. Lechuguilla is what the plant's called. But they're really, you know, they're really cool plants. And once again, we're talking about something that takes you know, years to reseed and years for these things to grow. And And now here in the northern end of the Chihuahua Desert, these Joshua trees, you know, sometimes you'll see a picture showing nice big ones. These are small, scraggy guys.
Yeah.
I mean, they're almost like they're, I would call them semi-bonsai. They get like maybe 8-9 feet tall, you know, 2 or 3 meters at most in height,
as
opposed to where further south they get a lot bigger.
And is it because it's much harsher there, Ken?
Yeah, I think the northern end here, where we live, it is pretty dry.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the mountains are where we have a lot of the, you know, we get all our moisture in the mountains. And once again, the mountain, you know, the water drains down from higher up into the desert areas. And one of the coolest basins we have here in the Chihuahuan Desert, Ken, is called White Sands National Monument.
I've heard of that.
It is amazing. It's basically was a large lake once upon a time, millions of years, thousands of years ago, tens of thousands of years ago when it was wetter. Became a saline basin, gypsum precipitated out, and now we have these huge dunes of gypsum sand that is pure white. And when you see this, it is one of the whitest sands you'll ever see on the planet. You know, I mean, there's just to the east of White Sands National Monument is a series of mountains called the Sacramento Mountains. And you can look down from the Sacramento Mountains across the Tularosa Basin, where the White Sands Desert is, and you can see it looks like an ocean. The sand is reflecting the blue of the sky, and it does. It looks like an ocean out there, but it's one of the most hostile places in New Mexico. I mean, hostile.
Wow, that's very interesting.
Now,
I guess there are animals that have evolved to live out there.
Well, one of the coolest animals, and I have actually had the experience to keep them one time, Ken, and that is a pupfish that comes from White Sands.
Really?
Supredodon tularosa, the White Sands pupfish. Beautiful little pupfish. These things are black. The males with an iridescent purple across their nape, and then they've got a yellow to orange cast in their pectoral, ventral, dorsal, and anal fins, with an orange cast to their throat, or yellow cast. You know, the males are gorgeous. And they live in several saline pools. Now, the springs that well up in the White Sands Desert are salty. They
Right.
Yeah, they have quite a salt content. And the water comes down from the surrounding mountains, and that's what these pupfish live in. They live in several small springs. Interestingly enough, you know, being that they're in a closed basin, originally I guess they entered from the south, and they were part of they're an offshoot of Spreadon variegatus.
All right.
Yeah. And but at any rate, that's one of the cool animals that we have living there in the White Sands Desert. There's not a lot of stuff in the White Sands Desert. It's one of the probably least. It's just not a whole lot of stuff there. It's really a closed basin for starters. So we've got all the rain gets wiped out by the mountains surrounding it. There's mountains to the west of the White Sands, and so. Other than some of the snakes, rattlesnakes that live there, some of the desert lizards, scorpions, spiders, and insects, you don't see too many animals out through it. I think there's, we do see the jackrabbits living along the edges because that's where it's greenest.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But the full-blown White Sands, I would not want to be lost in it, ever.
No.
Yeah. Kill you.
Mm-hmm. That's one thing I should have mentioned about the Australian deserts too. The water, by the time it gets into the center of the continent, is quite saline.
Yeah.
Actually, there's probably a little fish you've kept, maybe the desert goby from Australia.
I've never kept them, but I painted one not too long ago, Ken.
Right.
Actually,
Well, if you keep them, you've got to keep them in saline water to get them to breathe.
Yeah. But they've come from the deserts of Australia, too, huh?
Yeah.
How related they are to that one?
Fairly close, I believe.
Aha.
But the desert goby from Australia comes from permanent water, a system of permanent water holes in one very localized area from Australia. And at any one time, there might only, there's a lot more fish in aquariums around the world than there ever were at any one time in their habitat.
Wow. That's pretty wild.
It's like white cloud mountain fish, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They're so rare now that they think they're extinct in the wild.
Yeah.
But how many white clouds do you see swimming around in aquariums around the world?
Yeah. You know, there's billions of them.
Yeah.
Oh, that's pretty wild. You know, one of the cool things I like about the deserts here in North America is the different species of pupfish. Pupfish, we call them the canaries of the desert out here, Ken.
Mm-hmm.
Because, they're indigenous, of course, to the northern North American area. But the deserts here in New Mexico, Arizona, parts of Texas, parts of California, Nevada, excuse me, and of course Mexico. A lot of the desert springs have their own indigenous populations of pupfish.
Wow, and I've been separated long enough to speciate.
Well, usually, what's happened is the deserts here in North America are fairly young. I think geologically, they're less than 10,000 years old.
All right, yeah.
Yeah. So what we've seen here is as the back around 12 to 18,000 years ago, this area was believe it or not, this is green. Where I'm living now, where it's all grasslands going, except for the mountains as far as you can see.
Because mm-hmm.
That's what this is. It's for those who have been on my Facebook thing, they see pictures of trees and stuff. That's just in our local areas. I live on a high plains desert. And when this was greener, the rivers were flowing through here, the southwest area. Even Death Valley had a series of freshwater lakes and rivers flowing through it. It was wet.
Mm-hmm.
And the pupfishes were able to migrate up the Rio Grande River and different rivers, and they became as the ice age ended, this area started desertifying up, becoming drier and drier. So these little pupfish got isolated in the springs, and a lot of other fish were isolated with them. Now, it's not to say pupfish were here, because
right.
We also out here in the desert area. We've got the Gila minnow, Gila chub, I think. We've got several other minnow species that live, a couple other type of killifishes, some Goodia types. There's several species of Gambusia that live in these desert areas, too. So we have, a little bit of selection, but the population of, the species that seems to have shown the best ability to survive, because we'll see them in some of the saltwater springs and sometimes the only fish in a spring system out here, and that is the Sabrinodon, the pupfishes. They are very, very hardy. They can live in small areas. One of the amazing things I've always liked about them out here in the desert, they're really a cool fish. But one thing about them, though, Ken, there's no annual Sabrinodon. None of them have the ability to lay an egg that would survive the harsh desert areas. They have to live in
permanent water.
Yeah.
Why do you think it is, Ken, that these little fish that live in the desert have evolved such bright colors? Is it I can think of maybe two things. Sexual selection, obviously, that's always associated with bright colors, and lack of predators, maybe.
Maybe. Because there's a few pupfish that have a little bit of color to them, but for the most part, they're the blue, black, and grays. You know that? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
They've got a lot of. They do have quite a bit of color, though.
Well, when they're breeding, some of these
when
will pop
breeding,
up yellows. Yeah. They'll pop up oranges in the fins. And stuff. As I mentioned, the white sands pupfish, you know, it's real pretty. The breeding males, they've got a lot of yellow in them and stuff, and they're quite attractive. When you look at the Suprinon macularis, that's another pupfish that lives over in Arizona and parts of California. These fish turn blackish blue and with a neon blue on their back. These things are super attractive, but they're a blackfish, and some males have a grayish-colored tail and caudal peduncle, you know. And as far as I know, no pupfish has red. I think the closest we come to red in a pupfish are like the Suprinon variegatus populations that have orange and some of the close related species to that. That's about it. Other species out here, the only fish I can think of, well, no, that doesn't live in the desert. That lives in the mountains. You know, Ken, these desert fish are bland.
Except in courting season.
Yeah. I'll be darned. But probably, you know, they're, when you look at the pupfish habitats, they're no predators. Now, one of the problems that we have with our desert populations, this though, are introduced bass and tropical fish into these pools.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh, bad. Over in Ash Meadows, Nevada, that's part of the Mojave Desert. I've collected. Well, observed pupfish in the Ash Meadows habitat. And some of the pools have been decimated by back in the 60s and 70s where they were sucking all the water to grow crops.
Mm-hmm.
I believe the crop they were going to grow, this is going to really knock your knickers, was alfalfa, you know, to
really?
Feed the cattle and stuff. Yeah, that's what... the Rio Grande River, most of the water that's sucked out of the Rio Grande River through from Albuquerque down goes on to alfalfa fields here. Doesn't grow onto go into food crops. It just grows onto alfalfa.
Well,
and
I'll one up you there. I guess what they put a huge irrigation system. Very close to the Strzelecki Desert. Have a guess what they're trying to grow there.
I'm afraid to hear.
Cotton.
Really?
Yeah. That's
oh, my
so
God.
Water intensive. They put a huge irrigation system in. Cost them billions. They turned a river around and made it flow. Instead of flowing east to the ocean, they made it flow west.
Oh, my gosh.
Just to try and grow copper, and they abandoned it after about 20 years of not having any luck.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. I would not have been, you know, I could have predicted that result, huh? There's a town south of here. It's Fort Stockton, Texas, which is also in the heart of the Chihuahua Desert. I mean, it's right smack closer to the heart than where I'm at.
Right.
And it had a spring that had a pupfish species in it, Suprinon bovinus. And I visited that spring, Ken, several years ago. It's just a dry, cemented-in area. Hadn't had water in it for decades. They sucked it dry. And the area has been so ruined that creosote bush is about the only thing that grows in the surrounding area when you're driving out around the town of Fort Stockton, Texas.
Wow.
Because there's so much salinity in the water out here in these pools, these springs, they ruin the soil in just a matter of years. Yeah, you can't grow in a desert. It's not the magic place that people think it is, you know?
you can grow in the desert if you can try and grow the right thing.
Yeah.
You can't make it produce stuff like that shouldn't be there. I think that's the story that people just don't seem to get.
Yeah. Well, it's like the cattle out here. You know, it's seeing places here where the arroyos now, they used to be up real close to the surface. The water table, there's a little river system called the Rio Preco just east of the Rio Grande, or west of Rio Grande, but east mm-hmm. of here. And the Rio Preco now barely has water running, and it's dropped almost 30 feet in cut down, where the erosion has cut it down into the floodplain.
That's amazing.
Oh, my God, it's horrible. You know, to know that's how far the water table has dropped in the last 150 years here. And the grass has changed, you know, the different types from the one desert grass that was growing here. That's the grass species have changed over, you know. Like I said, it's these habitats are so delicate. And
have they stopped pumping they yet, Ken, or are they still persisting?
In
that particular locale.
I'm not sure what they're doing around Fort Stockton at the moment. I don't think they're pumping much because there's not much left to pump. The aquifer's been decimated,
left.
You know.
Yeah.
Yeah. And trying in Ash Meadows, you know, some of the fish groups and nature groups over in that area do go to Ash Meadows, and they remove the introduced fishes, like the convict cichlids, the bass, and also mollies and gambusia. Because these animals have a bad effect on the native pupfish and mm-hmm. other native minnows that actually live in these areas.
Wow, so, that's a problem, isn't it?
Yeah. Wow, we're at the top of the hour. Well, Ken, I want to invite all of our listeners to go visit deserts. You know, if you have never been to a desert, you know, go visit one and experience it, camp out in them. You know, but respect the delicate habitat. But one of the coolest things I did, Ken, the first time I come to the Chihuahuan Desert, we were down south by Carlsbad, New Mexico, and I was listening to the burrowing owls and the crickets, and that's all I could hear out in the middle of nowhere. It was just a little hoot of these little owls, you know, and the sound of the crickets in the desert. It was awesome. And the stars. Oh, my gosh, the stars when you're in the desert are just absolutely stunning. So they're magical places, actually.
I guess there's no pollution.
One
of the few places you can go without pollution and look at the stars and everything.
Yeah. So, but definitely a beautiful place to go, and definitely go check them out. So, well, tomorrow night, Ken, you and I are going to take our listeners on another adventure. We're going to talk about a really cool creature, and I want to talk about some of its movie roles and stuff like that, and that's the Pterosaur Pteranodon. So everybody want to join us for that.
Yeah, it should be a good one. Always something to learn new and always interesting.
Yeah, well, that's one of my favorite creatures. You know, I remember as a kid, seeing it in movies and stuff, you know, and it you see it in cartoons. So Pteranodon is an icon of the prehistoric age, I think. So we'll talk a little bit about Pteranodon. So, well, real quick here, Ken and I and Mary and all the others here at Nature Talks, I want you to follow us on Twitter and Facebook, iTunes, and go to www.blogtalk.com/Nature's Talk Show and press the follow button there as well, please. Also, you can go to our site, naturestalkshow.com, and click on the PayPal button there. You help donate money for our show. Check out and sign up for our web newsletter, of course. Visit our store and that's everything. Now, visit our chat room, as we mentioned. You can listen to our archive shows. Now, Ken and I want to invite everybody, if you have an idea or a suggestion for a show, please let us know, because many of these shows that we do, Ken and I will plan them around our listeners. So, we love bringing you know, stuff that you like. So you definitely want to check Ken and me out on that there. What else, Ken, can you think of?
Well, don't forget, we're making our first public appearance soon at the NEC convention, Northeast Council Convention at Rocky Hill, Connecticut. That is on April the 8th to the 10th. Come along, say good day to myself. I'm going to be there. Mary and Tom are both going to be there as well. We're going to be interviewing all the speakers there, various vendors and that. If you want to put your mug on our YouTube channel, come along. We'll talk to you. It'll be nice to meet someone.
Now, for our listeners out there, too. Yeah. For our listeners out there, too, I'm known as an artist and doing fish art. Matter of fact, I'm getting ready to do the awards for the American Killifish Association National Convention coming up here, you know. So I'm going to be sending some artwork to Ken Borman, and he will be presenting it down at the NEC conference for raffle to help support Nature's Talk Show. So you'll be able to win some of my artwork. You know, you won't have to pay more than the price of a raffle ticket and take home one of my famous paintings. So, Ken, I'll be getting that to you this coming week here. So you get to, Ken will be drooling over this here for a few months here before, or a few weeks before the show. So I hope he doesn't get it too sticky and everything, you know.
I'll buy all the tickets myself, Matt.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, you can pad the ballot box or the thing. Also, Ken Borman and I are going to be at the KOAC show. I'm going to be visiting there with them, and I'm going to bring some artwork there. We'll be talking. Hopefully, Ken and I will be doing a show from there, so we'll see how that goes. And I'm looking forward to hanging out with you, Ken. It's going to be a blast, you know.
Yes, and we'll be joined by Ron Bishop, our Tank Topics other co-host. The three of us will be all in the one place at the one time.
Yeah, so you can come out and visit with us. We can you can pick up artwork. Once again, I'll be displaying some of my fish art and nature artwork. It's here. Also, we'll be going making an appearance in Denver, Colorado at the American Killifish Association National Convention over Memorial Day weekend here in this coming May. So you can see me, Ken in Ken in April at NEC. Ken and me in May at London, Ontario, and then you can see me coming up Memorial Day weekend in Denver. We hope to see folks all there. Ken, anything else now?
I think we've got things covered.
All right, man. Well, thanks to all of our listeners. Thank you very much, Ken. I really enjoyed it. You taught me something very new about a fish, so I'm awesome.
Yeah, we'll have to do a show about that. I don't know which show we'll fit it in under, but we'll find something to talk about the dead fishes of Australia on for you.
Yeah, that's too fascinating. So with that there, thanks from everybody. Thanks from me, and goodbye, everybody. And we'll see you here next time on Nature's Talk Show, Nighty Night.
Good night from me.
Join us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. And listen to us at www.naturestalkshow.com.